We are now recording. Hear ye, this Honorable Appellate Court for the Second Judicial District is now open. The Honorable Susan F. Hutchinson presiding. Your Honors, the only case on the docket this morning is 2-21-0615, in re the marriage of Heidi Bess, Petitioner Appellee and Cross Appellant, and Arthur G. Bess III, Respondent Appellant and Cross Appellee. Arguing for the appellant, cross appellee, Ms. Margaret E. King. Arguing for the appellee, cross appellant, Mr. Benton H. Page.
All right, good morning, counsel. And we've gone through the preliminaries off the record, but now we're ready to proceed. And Ms. King, you may do so.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I am Margaret King, and I am representing appellant appellee Art Bess in this matter. Art Bess filed this appeal because of the trial court's improper treatment of a stock portfolio, the vast majority of which consisted of J.P. Morgan stock that Art held in his sole name at all times, and that were derived from non-marital sources, namely an inheritance from his mother, premarital purchases, or purchases through the use of non-marital collateral.
All right, Ms. King, let me ask just one question to straighten something out for myself. Yes. It appears that Raymond James account has more than just the shares that are at issue here. Was there any argument about those particular shares throughout the course of this rather lengthy proceeding?
About the other shares, the other 30%
contained. Oh, Bristol Myers, Disney, General Electric, Gilead, Intel, Moderna, Pfizer, and either Spirit or Sprint. I can't read my own handwriting.
There was argument that those particular securities were also non-marital as they derived from non-marital sources, but the tracing focused on the J.P. Morgan and the other Wind Trust shares.
Did these stocks remain in this Raymond James account throughout these proceedings?
The J.P. Morgan stock remained, and I can trace it from it being deposited into the account until judgment, essentially, until the last statement of trial.
Okay, and what about the we'll call them the odd shares now, since they haven't been highlighted. The Bank of America, Bristol Myers, are they still or were they still in the account at the time of the hearings?
I cannot answer because we were focusing on not the container as either being marital or non-marital, but the securities within the container.
Okay.
So the securities that we were tracing were the ones that derived directly from the Charter Bank stock and, through mergers, acquisitions, stock splits, et cetera, was deposited into the Baird account, which was the predecessor account for the Raymond James 7178 account.
There was at least one other Raymond James account before the 7178, correct?
It was a Baird account. So the Baird account, this is how it went, where all the J.P. Morgan stocks were held. There were 58,000 shares of J.P. Morgan held in a Raymond James account ending in 7178. And that's the main account at issue here. It the J.P. Morgan stock in that account represented 70% of all the assets contained within 7178. Then there were 12,000 shares of J.P. Morgan stock derived from the same source that were held in a Raymond James account ending in U990. Right. And this was titled in Art's sole name. It represented 100% of the assets in the account. So there was nothing but the J.P. Morgan stocks in UU90. And then there's the stipulated 6,600 shares that were held directly by Art in certificate form. And those were also titled in his own name.
So how many stocks of J.P. Morgan are at issue then here? All of those?
All of those. So the 76,600 shares are at issue.
All right.
And Despite the fact that these all came from a non-marital source, the trial court classified all of them as marital and awarded 75% of the aggregate value of the Raymond James 7178 account, which held the 58,000 shares of J.P. Morgan, to Heidi, as well as 6,600 certificate shares of J.P. Morgan. In contrast, Art was awarded his marital as marital property, 25% of the aggregate value of the Raymond James 7178 account, which held the 58,000 shares, as well as 12,000 shares of U-990. And this outcome was based on several substantial errors of law. The first I touched on, which was treating the Raymond James account as a 7178 as a single asset, when Illinois provides that accounts are mere receptacles for the assets they retain. So it is the assets and not the receptacle that are to be classified as marital or non-marital. Second, the court failed to apply relevant law to the facts regarding purchases of assets on margin. So the court omitted any mention of section 503A6.5 of the Illinois Marriage and Dissolution of Marriage Act, which governs the use of what the margin purchases were. And finally, the court erred in ruling that the deposit of assets into the 7178 account, again, which was titled in Art's own name alone, was sufficient to transmute the assets deposited. There was no presumption of a gift for a solely titled account. Now, this outcome, the court's judgment, was also against the manifest weight of the evidence. And even though the court noted that the ruling had to be driven by the documentary evidence, the court actually failed to engage with such evidence.
Specifically, right, well, Ms. Keene, your argument in your brief often talks about a domino effect coming from the very beginning. And I think that very beginning is $74,850 deposit that doesn't really become an issue until we get to trial. According to your client and your brief, you said your client didn't know that there was no interrogatory that addressed this asset. I think I found some interrogatories that have, but be that as it may, why does this not show up? Or why don't we have some other proof of this non-marital status of this money that was wired in? Where did it go? What was it?
Well, this $74,000 was received contemporaneously with the death of Art's father. And he died many years prior to the actual...
I think this was 1998, I think this money.
Right. So it was in 1997, in December 1997, he died. Then it was deposited into the Baird account. The interrogatories, that was long before the filing of this case.
Correct.
That money had been placed in 7178 for so long ago that it's not something that would be considered non-marital property to be listed on an interrogatory.
Could you not trace the origin of that wire transfer? I mean, isn't the burden on you to be able to say where that came from? Regardless of how long ago it was, I mean, banks keep records. Wouldn't you be able to prove where it came from?
Well, that happened decades before the filing. Banks normally don't keep records that far back. And there was testimony by my client explaining that this is where it came from.
I appreciate that, but that's what I'm saying. Other than any testimonial evidence, is there any other evidence as to what the source of this wire transfer was?
Well, you can look to what other assets were in existence at that time. So there were personal financial statements that Art filled out on an annual basis. And on there, you could see the total of assets of where things could come from. There were very few assets that could have been used to deposit $74,000. And it would have encompassed almost 50% of the income that year if it were just some income earned, you know, from his work at Best Hardware.
Well, so at Best Hardware, he never took what would be considered the CEO salary. He took a basic salary, as I believe the record shows, and the tax returns likewise show that. And all this time he's trading. He's maybe not every single year, but significantly he is trading during this period of time. So how can we tell what he was trading, or how can we take that figure against what might have been there and what came later? I mean, it's clear and convincing evidence is what you needed to show. And how did you show that?
So at Best Hardware, it was never a money maker. He never received large amounts. And it wasn't because he was underpaying himself. He was paying himself appropriately given the income that it generated, that Best Hardware generated. You know, one thing I will say is it really doesn't matter in the entire analysis whether or not that $74,850 was marital or non-marital, because the effect that it had on the JP Morgan stock is minimal. The only effect that that money would have is to the extent that securities that were purchased using that $74,850 were used to secure the margin, which then purchased new stock, which ultimately became JP Morgan.
Right, but counsel, the question was, how did you prove that by clear and convincing evidence? I appreciate where you're going into a different argument, but where's your proof, clear and convincing, as to the origin of that $74,000?
So I would argue.
Oh, Ms. Keene, I'm sorry, if you could start over, we've lost you for a second.
The earnings were relatively modest. Art's earnings were relatively modest, as I mentioned. The personal financial statements every year showed there were no marital assets from which money could have been withdrawn. The 1998 tax returns show that he would have had to direct 50% of the family's total net income to that investment. And again, there are funds that he received more than 20 years prior. There's no evidence contradicting his testimony. In fact, the circumstances support his testimony. So there's no reason to disregard evidence or testimony which follows the circumstances when there's nothing else showing an opposite conclusion could be reached.
When you say 50% of the total net income, are you talking about employment income, or are you talking about
income shown on his tax returns?
Okay. And does this $78,000 ever show up anywhere on any of those documents that we're talking about here?
No. It wouldn't, because he testified that it belonged to Best Hardware. It was a Best Hardware policy for which he was a beneficiary. It was paid for by Best Hardware. So it would not show up on any of his personal financial statements because it was an asset of the company.
But Best Hardware had records that could have been presented, didn't they? Or where were those records? This business has been going since the mid-60s, I think, or early 60s, pardon me.
Unfortunately, there were new records. It's the 20 years. We were very lucky that he had the records he did, all of the personal financial statements dating back so long. It's practically unheard of for somebody to have the level of documentation over such a long period of time. And businesses normally don't keep such records for so long. Record keeping is usually for a 7-year period.
But he seemed to be a pretty good record keeper of, at least he says he is, of his personal and his stock business, because things were produced. And he was, for a very long time, the sole owner of Best Hardware. So why wasn't he keeping records there?
I believe he kept many records for Best Hardware, and many were part of the record in this case, part of the evidence in this case. Unfortunately, the check relating to that particular policy and the proceeds, he did not have.
All right, Ms. Keene, I appreciate your knowledge of this case, and I'm sure Mr. Page has a similar knowledge. The Judge Christensen seemed to have a good handle on what went where, but why wasn't there maybe a forensic accountant who came in and actually talked about this to the court?
I was not the trial counsel for this case.
Correct. So
I cannot speak to the decisions that were made in dealing with the trial counsel. I do think that the belief was that the records were somewhat easy to follow. They were all in evidence. And the reason I say they're somewhat easy to follow is that really the only tracing that is difficult is at all, I would say mostly difficult, is the Baird tracing. And that's for a very short period of time. Once you get into the Raymond James era, when the Baird account is transferred into Raymond James, it's by lot and there's not much movement. And lots, I believe it's 1 and 2, you can follow it from 2004 all the way through to the date of judgment.
Now, were those documents presented to the trial court or were those attached to the motion to reconsider?
So the documents themselves, so the underlying statements, were part of the evidence at trial. And then after the judgment, and I'm assuming it was determined that maybe she didn't follow the tracing, then the motion to reconsider set forth additional detailed tracing.
All right. That's usually not the way to introduce evidence to a court, attaching it to a motion. It doesn't appear that the trial court did consider it. And I believe Mrs. Bess feels that it is either waived, those are waived or forfeited because they should have been presented at the trial court level. I know you didn't try the case, but that's still an issue that you need to answer.
So I would argue that throughout the trial, it was stated that all of these J.P. Morgan stocks were non-marital. There was testimony talking about how they were kept. There was testimony about where they started from the charter bank group on, talked about when they were deposited into the Baird account, the transition from the Baird account into the Raymond James. So there was testimony regarding all of this, and the evidence was admitted.
But the trial court did not believe and was clear that she did not believe your client on the issue of this $74,000.
But that is back to what I would like to clarify, is that whether or not that $74,000 is marital is really inconsequential to the overall analysis.
How can it be de minimis? Don't you have to first prove that it's non-marital in order to claim the de minimis argument?
I think that if it's marital, its contribution was only to the security, the collateral, and at most the collateral that it, the what would be marital contribution to the collateral, was less than 2%. In the reply brief, I have a chart showing that what the ratio of alleged marital versus non-marital security is in the purchase of a total of 9,000 shares of Bank One stock. And that's really what's at issue, because everything else can be traced to a solely non-marital source.
And the trial court saw that chart that we're seeing.
Well, the trial court had all of the documents in evidence. And if something is in evidence, the trial judge should be engaging in it when looking and making his decision.
Well, she's certainly engaged in something, because the judgment is rather complete. I mean, it has more than I've seen in most judgments for dissolution of marriage. Rather than writing a memo and then a judgment, she just sort of combined, I think, the two. And she seems to have caught most of that. But yet, I just want to be sure that we're not seeing something that she didn't see, or maybe even the form that she didn't see it in.
Well, all of these, there's nothing that I am presenting that was not part of the record. Everything is contained in the record. There's nothing new.
Except those lot charts, which really aren't contained in the record. They're attached to a motion. They weren't introduced as
we consider correct. However, the statements themselves demonstrate the lots. So if one were to look at the statements, you see the lots right there.
Right. You haven't had a chance to talk about Wintrust. If you want to spend a minute or two with that, we can listen.
Okay, well, the inherited shares, I think, is a very good example of the tracing, and that includes some Wintrust stock as well. And I feel like this shows kind of an open and shut tracing for the court to understand. Then if this comes clear, then maybe we can kind of go into the other tracings with it.
So this is from his mother's estate?
This is his mother's estate. There was a 21st century account ending in 1127 that held only the inherited shares. No other funds were deposited. He then deposited the shares from the 21st century account on January 21st, 2009, into the Raymond James 7178. And that, a chart that I attached to the appendix at A114, it's the inherited shares chart. And the initial deposit had a 2,000 shares of Bank of America, 2,000 shares of Wintrust, and 23,804 shares of J.P. Morgan. These shares were put into lots, readily distinguished lots, and which was the standard method for Raymond James at that point. And these made the inherited shares identifiable and distinguishable in the account. And if you look at the chart, you can follow it over a period of 11 years. And during that 11-year period, 10,304 J.P. Morgan shares were sold. So as of the date, approximate to the date of judgment, September 30th, 2020, the Raymond James 7178 account held 13,500 shares of J.P. Morgan, 2,000 shares of Bank of America, and 2,000 shares of Wintrust, all of which were the very same shares that were deposited into the account from the 21st century inherited account. So that they were worth $1,427,925 as of September 30th. And I believe that tracing is done with clear and convincing evidence. I see my time is up. So if you'd like me to.
Well, let me, Justice Jorgensen, do you have any other questions at this time?
I do not, not at this time.
And Justice Shostak. All right. Ms. Keene, you will have your opportunities, as we've already discussed. Coming up, we'll let Mr. Page weigh in at this time, if he is ready to proceed. Mr. Page.
I am, Justice, and may it please the court. My name is Benton Page of Bierman LLP, appearing on behalf of the petitioner, appellee, and cross-appellant Heidi Bess, and good morning to you, Justices.
Good morning.
And I appreciate the attention you all clearly have paid to the briefs in this very dense and complicated manner. This appeal centers around the trial court's classification of the party's assets, mainly Arthur's contention that the vast majority of the party's approximately $20 million estate derived from his premarital assets or inherited assets.
Well, Mr. Page, do you agree or are you focusing on that $74,000 invest or deposit to essentially establish your case that it's all marital property?
That is certainly a part of it, Justice Hutchinson. And to that point, there are a few issues with that deposit. As you noted, there is the interrogatory that had been posed to him, asking him to state the basis for any non-marital claims that he'd be asserting, which he didn't do. He left it rather vanilla, to say the least. And I was trial counsel. We were scrambling at the last minute to put this together as he produced a lot of documents before. But in any event, he did not identify that $74,000 deposit as a life insurance policy at the time of his interrogatory answers, nor did he identify it in his deposition.
Let me ask if this was truly a Bess Hardware entity, would he have had to note it on that interrogatory?
I believe so, to the degree he was going to assert at trial that that was part of the basis for his non-marital claim, which he ultimately did. I believe that that is responsive to that interrogatory, and he was required to do so. Trial court. I'm sorry, Justice. Please go ahead.
You're mute.
What percentage was that of the overall estate, and is it de minimis? Is it not de minimis, I should ask?
Yeah, the relevance of that $74,000 deposit, and I don't mean to give a long-winded answer to a simple question, at the time he deposited it, it was the vast majority of that account. And the relevance became that once he deposited that, and there were a number of cash and securities deposits for which there was no tracing before that deposit, is that served as the basis and the collateral for the stock purchases from the Baird account and later the Raymond James accounts throughout the rest of the marriage. So once that was in, and it was verified by both Mr. Bess as well as his financial advisor, Mr. McGarren, that $74,000 deposit and the other shares that Mr. Bess had previously deposited into the Baird account served as collateral for the myriad stock purchases that took place thereafter.
As collateral, did any money exchange from that account, or was it as what might be considered pure collateral, just security that whatever money is going to be paid is backed up by this particular amount of money? And does that make a difference that no money was exchanged?
I don't know that it makes a difference, Justice. While the statement is, I think, a little bit backwards, it appears that Mr. Bess purchased about five different types of stock with that $74,000 deposit. You know, the inner working of a margin line is such that you don't need it if you have cash in the account. But to the degree you have stocks you've acquired in the account and insufficient cash to purchase additional stock, you can use these stocks in the account as collateral for the additional purchases. So as I read the statements, Mr. Bess approximately simultaneously deposited that $74,000 and then used that $74,000 to purchase five different stocks that thereafter served as the collateral. The import of that being that when he thereafter purchased various stocks several months later, in August of 1998, including some First Chicago National Bank stock, as well as a number of others, that was the collateral that was used to purchase those stocks. And since it was under Section 503A6.5, which provides that if the solely non-marital property is used to acquire, as collateral to acquire other assets, that the proceeds of the loan in question may be non-marital property, but that wasn't the case here since it wasn't the sole collateral. his alleged non-marital property was not the sole collateral by any measure. So all of the stock acquisitions from that point forward were marital property by definition.
So counsel, Ms. Keene answered my question about de minimis, whether it had to be first considered marital, whether there had to be first a consideration of marital or non-marital of that property in order to get into a de minimis argument. She didn't seem to indicate that that was an issue, the classification. What your position is otherwise?
It is, Justice. Looking at the case law, you know, there really is no de minimis exception to the general rule under both 503C2, providing for when assets are acquired during the marriage using a combination of non-marital and marital property, as is there no exception under section 503A6.5, where at least some marital property serves as the collateral for a loan. So to the degree Mr. Bess is asserting that there is some de minimis exception to the general rule that all...
The rule is not the only thing that would control. There are some cases that discuss de minimis. And if I cite the wrong case, it's early on Monday morning, and there are a lot of cases here. But yes. With the Wearies case, one of them that talked about de minimis money, or
I believe so. And counsel cited another Fifth District case that I can try to find it. I think I have it in my notes here somewhere. It'll come to me. But in any event, counsel cited...
Well, how do you distinguish those then?
Siddons, I believe, is the case she cited for the de minimis argument. And that particular case rested on the notion that there was marital property that was contributed to a non-marital account, which is quite a different thing than this situation, which it would have been non-marital property to the degree Mr. Bess's tracing through 1998 is believed, contributed to a marital property account. But moreover, the assets that were later acquired with the margin line and the combination of marital and non-marital property, again, assuming the crediting of his tracing, would be under section 503C2, marital property. So I think for those reasons, it is quite distinguishable. I think in Siddons, the issue was that the marital contributions to non-marital property would create, at best, a reimbursement error, and the burden would shift to the spouse claiming the reimbursement to prove the by clear and convincing evidence the right to reimbursement, whereas here we have the opposite situation.
Now, Mr. Page, I asked Ms. Keene the same thing. We know there is a fair amount of money involved in this particular case. And there were appraisers that testified, and there were there was the accountant who had handled, I believe, Mr. Bess's account for a significant period of time. But it seems to me, reading this case, that this is a little more complicated than some appraisers who are certainly well qualified, and an accountant who's been taking care of things but doesn't have records either. Why didn't your client, or why didn't you, since you were part of the trial, situation, why didn't you hire an expert? I know it wasn't you. I don't want an answer. It wasn't my responsibility. I didn't have the order of proof. I get that. But why weren't you trying to protect, or why didn't Ms. Bess try to protect her theory with an expert?
It's an excellent question, Justice, and the answer is we did. Larry Goldsmith was the forensic accountant who testified on behalf of Ms. Bess at trial. And he was a forensic accountant, but he addressed five or six of the particular assets that Mr. Bess asserted were his non-marital property.
That's true, but you're right. He was a forensic accountant, but
Your Honor, pardon my interruption, but it looks like Justice Jorgensen has... Oh, there, I'm sorry. I apologize. I didn't see you on the screen. Something changed on my screen. My apologies for the interruption.
No problem. She did change position on my screen, as did Justice Shostak. What are you two doing? Musical chairs? But that's okay. he was, okay, he was this type of an accountant, a forensic accountant, but he didn't really, I believe the trial court did not give much shrift to his testimony either. She said she didn't consider it.
That is true. And, you know, I wish she could have given more explanation why she didn't. I mean, frankly, some of the explanations that she gave for classifying certain assets aligned with his arguments or his testimony. But she did indeed state that she did not consider his testimony much in rendering the decision.
Well, if she didn't consider Mr. Goldsmith's testimony and she didn't believe some of Mr. Bess's testimony, and your client really wasn't involved in a lot of these transactions, who did she rely on?
I think she relied largely on the documents and the fact that the burden of proof was not met by Mr. Bess, who had it throughout this tracing. At least that's the way I read her judgment, as well as her ruling on post-trial motions rendered 3 months later.
And what is your position on these sheets attached to the motion to reconsider? Are they merely summaries of the other exhibits that the court had, or what do you see them as?
I see them as an attempt to re-argue and present arguments that were not made properly at the time of summation. The original lot tracing argument was presented for the first time in Mr. Bess's motion to reconsider following the entry of judgment, in which he attached a lot chart. And we pointed out in our response to the motion to reconsider that there were some errors in that lot chart, and quite a few of them, as well as a five-year gap in terms of the tracing between 2012 and 2017. And, you know, the motion to reconsider is not a time to raise whole new arguments. The lot argument, in our view, should have been raised in summation. Rather, and there's cases on this point, but Mr. Bess felt he lost in the judgment and query whether that's true, but then he furiously put together wholly new evidentiary materials for the trial court to reconsider. The lot chart.
But didn't the trial court have this information? It is now just in a different, I'm going to use Ms. Keene's word, receptacle, than it was in the actual documents presented to the trial court?
That's a great question, Justice. And some of it was, without a doubt, reflected in the account statements and what have you that were presented to the trial court at trial. Some of it was not. There were years in which, you know, I think it was 2002 to 2006 in the Raymond James account statements that they don't identify any lots of stock in the JP Morgan, I believe it was JP Morgan at that time, stock, as well as the Wintrust sometime thereafter. So there were, you know, at the very least, a four-year gap that he presents as, you know, meet lots of stock in which there was no such thing reflected in the statements, as well as, again, the gap in statements between 2012 and 2017. So I would agree that some of it is reflected there. We did point to some errors in terms of what was presented in the lot charts in our motion, our response to Mr. Bess's motion to reconsider. But again, you know, this was an argument, this lot idea and theory was not presented in any way, shape, or form in summation, and was a new argument at that time.
What was the trial court's actual response to that, these documents? Were they even considered? Well, did she even say she considered them? I can't say what she did in her head, but did she say she considered them?
You know, I believe she said she considered them in her ruling on post-trial motions, entered in October of 2021. However, she, as I recall, without looking at it right now, stated that she felt between all of the purchases and sales over the period of time between, that's depicted in that lot chart, some of the inaccuracies in it and the inability to identify exactly what related to Mr. Bess's premarital holdings and what did not, that she stuck to her soup pot analogy that she included in both the judgment and the ruling on post-trial motions. So I think she considered it, certainly. I just don't think she gave it a lot of weight or credit. As to the general issue here, you know, the contention by Mr. Best is that the approximately $214,000 he held in premarital stock ballooned to some $8,184,000 that he's claiming that the trial court erred in classifying as marital property. The law on this point is fairly clear. Ultimately, any doubts as to the nature of the property are resolved in finding that the property is marital. In this case, the initial tracing, I think, is rather important. While a lot of the focus is on what happened once there were account statements that can be viewed and reconciled to some extent, before that, Mr. Bess, and it's undisputed, had Charter Bank stock. The Charter Bank stock that he held merged somewhere shortly after the marriage, and that too is disputed, not disputed. What is disputed is what happened thereafter. Mr. Best testified that he received 26,778 shares of NBD stock in exchange for his Charter Bank stock. And while there are some questions because he had more stock certificates in NBD than he did in Charter Bank, which is usually not the case where it's a merger and stock is traded in, the real question comes thereafter. In the years that followed, Mr. Best had that 26,000 and change shares of NBD. He sold 4,108 of those shares in 1992, leaving about 22,670 shares. However, according to his personal financial statement, by 1994, he had 49,460 NBD shares. Arthur did not, at trial, supply any evidence as to how he acquired those additional 26,790 NBD shares. And there was nothing about a stock split, as he asserts in his brief, as part of the record, either through testimony, through any other documents. And the only basis or citation that Mr. Best provides for that alleged stock split is through a reference to his personal financial statement, which again does not reference a stock split. Since Mr. Best acquired those additional 26,790 shares of NBD stock, it was his obligation to show by clear and convincing evidence that he acquired them by one of the means and exceptions of Section 503A of the Illinois Marriage and Dissolution of Marriage Act, which he didn't do. There's no evidence presented whatsoever on that point. As to the next particular exchange, Mr. Best testified that he exchanged his NBD shares for shares of First Chicago National Bank some years later, shortly before he opened the Baird account. But again, the only evidence of that was his personal financial statement. So there was no evidence presented as to the basis for which he traded the NBD shares for the First Chicago National Bank shares, or exactly what consideration he got. Cash or some other
form. What would we be looking for when you say there's absolutely no evidence? What would we be looking for to establish evidence other than his financial statements?
You know, there are myriad ways you can do that. As he did with his charter shares, he produced a statement from the Charter Bank Group indicating that, Mr. Bess, here is our plan of merger and how much you will get of each Charter Bank Group stock in exchange for your Charter Bank stocks at the various banks, which is, in my experience, pretty typical of that. He presumably traded in his stock certificates as he provided the Charter Bank Group stock certificates and the NBD certificates to show that they were traded in and that they had been canceled and that he had new certificates. For the additional NBD shares, again, he didn't provide any evidence of a stock split at trial. He didn't provide any evidence of the shares he held in NBD being traded in for the First Chicago National Bank when that purportedly happened. The only evidence he provided regarding the latter was his own testimony, and there was no evidence whatsoever regarding his acquisition of that additional 26,000 and change NBD shares. The import of that is that when Mr. Best deposited First Chicago National Bank shares into the Baird account in 1998, August of 1998, there was no way to determine whether the shares that were deposited emanated from the shares he received in exchange for the Charter Bank Group or in exchange for the NBD, or the shares that he received during the marriage, that 26,000 and change. And nor is there any way to determine from that point forward what, if any of those shares were the shares acquired during the marriage, shares that he testified he received in exchange for shares he held before the marriage, or some combination of the two. And from that point forward, there was simply no way for the trial court to determine, at least not by the clear and convincing evidence standard, what portion of the Baird account was either in exchange for premarital shares and wasn't.
Did your client have a theory of how those were acquired?
No, I think when she testified at trial, was largely left in the dark, other than some conversations with Mr. Bess regarding the Northview Financial Bank shares that he acquired. She had some involvement in hosting parties and the like, but that was about the extent of her involvement in their financial lives. She did resume working later in the marriage, but she was largely, and I'll tell you, my client really had no idea they had the wealth they did until they got divorced. But she really knew very little about what had transpired over the years until we began receiving discovery. And I'm sure she did not anticipate that it would be as complicated and lengthy a process as it's been. I see my time is up and I don't want to keep Justice.
Well, we'll give you a little bit more time because I allowed Ms. Keene a little more time. We've covered JP Morgan. Have you covered Wintrust as far as you want to cover it?
I think so, Justices. I mean, I don't mean to make you refer to my brief any more than you already have, but I think it's pretty well laid out, the nature of the various purchases of Wintrust stock over time, which were largely not documented and not provided the proof of where the funds came from. And some of it, again, came by his own testimony in exchange for his efforts as the director of the Northview Financial Bank.
Go ahead.
I was going to turn my cross appeal, so if you have a question about, certainly defer.
Justice Jorgensen or Justice Shostak, any questions about where we are now? They're both shaking their head. All right, go ahead.
Okay, very good. The cross appeal presented by Ms. Bess is fairly straightforward and simple. And that's, did Mr. Bess meet his burden of proof to show that he used exclusively non-marital property to acquire his interest in Bess Capital Corporation and the real property located at 1875 Willow Road in Northfield, Illinois, which I'll refer to as the Willow property? And the answer is no. The argument regarding Bess Capital Corporation that the trial court adopted was that it was a, quote, continuation of Bess Investments, which it is agreed was a premarital partnership interest Mr. Bess had, though he did acquire some of the interest in that partnership from his father in, I believe, 1995, perhaps 1996. But the Bess Capital Corporation was incorporated in November of 1995 as a wholly new business entity. Arthur's testimony that he merely changed the name of Bess Investments to Bess Capital Corporation is refuted by that articles of incorporation. There's no indication by any documents he provided that, as he said, Bess Investments became Bess Capital Corporation. On the 1995 partnership return for Bess Investments, it reported assets of approximately $300,000. And when he amended the Bess Investment Partnership Agreement about the same time as he formed Bess Capital Corporation in November of 1995, there was no mention of Bess Capital Corporation whatsoever. The two entities are both referred to similarly on his income tax returns in the 1995-1996 individual income tax returns that Mr. and Ms. Bess filed. And they were two separate entities with their own distinct employer identification numbers. So the argument that there was a continuation of it, to the degree that's an exception under Section 503A, it was simply not consistent with the evidence presented at trial. The only asset that Bess Investments apparently owned was this Glenview Road property, Glenview, Illinois. However, that particular entity, the evidence showed, had been owned by a land trust since the beginning of time, and the land trust documents were not provided.
We're not what? I'm sorry.
We're not provided at trial. We're not submitted evidence at trial.
Do you dispute that that's a land trust?
No, indicated in the deeds for the property is for the Glenview Road property was an indication it was owned by a land trust. So I'm assuming it was. However, that was not part of the evidentiary record or until you produced at any point in discovery. So, who exactly the beneficial owner of that land trust was somewhat mysterious. I'm assuming at some point Mr. Bess transferred the ownership, the beneficial ownership of the Glenview Road property to the Best Capital Corporation, as indicated in the tax returns. Beyond that.
Which would still make it non-marital, correct?
The Glenview Road property was undisputedly
non-marital. Undisputed, right.
Yeah. That doesn't mean that the entity that owned it was, but there's no question that the property itself was not. As to the Willow Road property, the trial court did not really reason out its determination in at least the ruling on post-trial motions as to why it determined it was non-marital. The property
didn't Willow Road come as part of the inheritance from his mother's estate?
No, that was the East Circle property that he received half of as part of his mother's inheritance.
Shared with his sister?
That was the one, correct, that he later bought out his sister's interest using a combination of the Raymond James 7178 account and a loan that he later paid off the Raymond James 7178 account. The Willow Road property is the property in Northfield that he acquired, I believe it was in 1997 or 1998, using a $900,000 mortgage, purchase price mortgage, $10,000 in earnest money, and about $206,000 in cash at closing. Mr. Bess's testimony on the subject of where exactly that $206,000 came from was, to say the least, all of it. He at one point testified that it came from some combination of a certificate of deposit from Bess Hardware, as well as a $46,000 loan or gift from his father. His testimony varied between his deposition and his trial testimony, and his trial testimony differed at various times on that point. What was not in dispute was that the $10,000 earnest money that Mr. Bess paid for the property was from any non-marital source. He never asserted that, he never provided any evidence of it, and he never testified that it came from a non-marital source. As it did under Section 503(2), the property acquired in part with marital property and with non-marital property, irrespective of where that $206,000 came from, was marital property. As to the $206,000, however, there was simply no cogent evidence of where it came from. In his deposition, Art testified he used the proceeds of the sale of NBD stock to fund the purchase of the Willow Road property. After being reminded that he had also testified he hadn't sold any NBD stock, Art changed his testimony and testified that he recalled $150,000 coming from a Best Hardware CD and $56,000 or $46,000 coming from a loan or gift from his father. He corrected his testimony and said he'd have to go back and try to find the actual papers, but he couldn't, which, again, is far from clear and convincing evidence. Art did admit the certificate of deposit in question into evidence, but the certificate of deposit showed that it had a maturity date long after the purchase of the property. So it made little sense that he would have purchased a certificate of deposit with a maturity date after the closing to fund the purchase of this property. As to the source of funds to purchase the certificate of deposit, his testimony was that he thought it was purchased with the retained earnings of Best Hardware, which the trial court classified as marital property. So regardless of the $206,000 source, the $10,000 earnest money would render the property marital property. However, the testimony regarding the source of that $206,000 cash to close was hardly clear or convincing. It was the contrary, all over the place, and not consistent with the other evidence provided. So for those reasons,
one question. Yes. You had said earlier that this was more than a name change, because on the either the 95 or 96 tax returns, both entities are listed. Therefore, they could never have been a single entity. Is that your position?
They're both listed. They could never have been. You're correct, Justice. I think, if I'm reading your question correctly, that the mere fact that they both show up on a tax return does not mean that they couldn't be the same entity, right? You could change the name part of the year through. The import of that in this case is they both had different employer identification numbers on their tax returns, and thus were distinct entities. And again, aside from Mr. Bess's testimony that it was a continuation, I don't even believe there's a mechanism to convert a partnership interest into a corporation, but to the degree there is, these two were under the documents provided, not the same, and were distinct entities. And I realize I've gone well over my time, and I thank you for your patience, and I will defer unless you just have any further questions.
And I don't either. Thank you very much, Mr. Page. I think we're going to hear from you again, but we're getting there.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, we're going now to Ms. Keene. If you wish to respond, you may do so.
Thank you very much. I want to start by talking about the collateral used to purchase stock, JP Morgan stock, in the Baird account. Mr. Page had indicated that the entirety of the $74,000 was used as securities to buy that stock, and that is just simply not true. The Baird account marks what is used as security with an M on the statement. And that means that it's part, that particular security is part of the margin security. That's what the M stands for. So I created a chart citing the record citations to the Baird statements to show what particular securities were used to purchase all of the different stocks at different times. And we can go through the tracing of the purchases of the JP Morgan stock and show that very rarely was there any stock that was used or that was purchased using that $74,000 when more JP Morgan stocks were purchased.
So where is that chart in the record, counsel?
I created the chart, and it's a summation of the documents, the Baird documents that are in the record. And there are record citations to each of those particular statements. So for example, there, if you look to the tracing chart at A111 of the appendix, immediately upon depositing the 17,472 shares of First Chicago Bank into the Baird account, Art immediately made two additional purchases of First National Bank of Chicago on August 3rd, 1998. One for 5,900 shares, and one for 2,100 shares. So a total of 8,000 shares. Those shares purchased on margin had zero marital collateral. And so between August 1st and August 31st, 1998, the margin was secured only by the 25,472 shares of First Chicago and 4,000 shares of Bank Women. So the newly purchased 8,000 shares joined the existing 17,472 shares for a new 100% non-marital security total of 25,472. And then when On August 25th, 1998, when ARC purchased on margin 4,000 additional shares of Bank One, those shares were added to the margin security, which again were used purchased with 100% non-marital collateral. So thereafter, there were sales and purchases of Bank One stock, right? So ARC sold 6,000 shares on 5/13/99. He purchased 3,500 shares on 8/2/99, 3,000 shares on 9/3/99, 4,000 shares on 9/16/99, and 2,000 shares on 9/22/99. The first purchase of 3,500 shares on 8/2/99, 200 shares of Compact are included to with the Bank One as security, but those shares of Compact were purchased using the Bank One shares of security. It was not part of the original $74,000 purchase. So then it's only the 9,000 shares of Bank One during September that were secured by Bank One shares and Compact shares, which included 525 shares of Compact that were purchased using the $74,850 of life insurance proceeds. So even if the proceeds were not deemed, were deemed to be marital, not non-marital, that contribution to the collateral itself would be de minimis. And as I said, at most, we're talking less than 2% contribution. At most, we had a difference between, we have about 2.5 million in all non-marital and somewhere in the realm of 50,000 that could potentially be deemed marital. And there's a chart, as I mentioned in my reply brief, setting that those ratios forward. So
now if the court did not believe some of the testimony, and she said she didn't, some of the testimony of Mr. Bess, isn't that going to impact this trace that you just did on this chart?
This tracing is purely based on the documents. You do not have to find the $74,000 to be non-marital to keep the stock from flipping to marital property. And there was some discussion about there's no de minimis concept here. And the de minimis concept is all over in the law. It's very plain. I've cited to Foster, where Foster says that Smith was used to remedy the result by the Supreme Court, where the court held a non-marital apartment building valued at $45,000 transmuted into marital property because of a $3,800 contribution. Transmutation can occur only where the contribution of marital assets to non-marital property is significant. And I find it very hard to believe that that would not carry over into a situation where collateral is being used. The non-marital or the marital property is not harmed in any way by such a de minimis use of marital property as collateral. So it to me, it doesn't follow that the contribution to a new asset has to be significant in order to flip it. But yet, collateral, it could be, you know, a tiny drop and then everything switched. It just would lead to absurd results. And then I wanted to also discuss the tracing as it related to the original Charter Bank stock. There is some notion that somehow there was no way to trace the charter from the original what he originally owned in 1985. A year before the marriage, he owned 3,913 shares in 5 small banks. Facts in the public record tie out the number of shares reflected on his financial statement year after year exactly to the total number ultimately deposited into the Bear account. So the 17,472 of First Chicago on 3/8/1998 and the $52,112 of Bank One on 2/25/2000. That's all traceable. So if you, after, in December 31st, 1996, there was a consolidation. Art was left with 26,778 shares of Charter Bank Group stock. And this was shown on his personal financial statement in 1987. Then in 1988, NBD Bancorp acquired Charter Bank Group, and Art received 23,296 shares of NBD Bancorp in a 0.08741 exchange rate, which is a matter of public record. This exact number of shares, 23,296, is listed on his 1998 financial statement.
Long and short is that he then transferred all of that into the Raymond James account, correct?
All of it then, ultimately, through all of these iterations, the stock splits, the mergers, everything ultimately was deposited into Bear. But there is a clear tracing of that stock from the original Charter Bank stock. In 1989, there was a 3-for-2 stock split for the MBD Bancorp stock, and that resulted in Art having 39,944 shares of MBD Bancorp. So if you would multiply 1.5 by 23,296, you would get that amount of shares, and that's a matter of public record, that exchange rate.
We know what his statement said, his personal financial statement, but what was presented to establish that it was that stock split or whatever created that amount of stock?
These were facts that were the trial court was asked to take judicial notice of. They are in the public record. They are readily verifiable. They're in general knowledge, well established, and a court can take judicial notice of such facts in the public record at any point in proceedings.
Well, that's true, but how is the court going to get there? You know, is court just going to go? What does the court look for?
Well, there was testimony about some stock splits and some mergers, and some mergers were very clear because NBD Bancorp became First National Bank of Chicago. First National Bank of Chicago became Bank One. Charter Bank Group became NBD Bancorp stock. So there was an explanation for all of it, and it can be traced mathematically to the deposit into Baird.
But did you ever ask the court to take judicial notice of something, or did you present the evidence as part of this clear and convincing responsibility that you had?
So in the motion to reconsider, I know that it was specifically stated outright that these stock splits, et cetera, could be taken. The court could take judicial notice of them. There was testimony about—
Does the court, all right, then let's ask this question. Does the court's own maybe diligence in looking for this, is that part of your clear and convincing evidence, or are you supposed to? And again, I understand you weren't trial counsel, but isn't trial counsel responsible to present the evidence?
Understood. I believe the personal financial statements are very strong evidence of what was in existence at the time and following it through. I think that some of these mergers were well known in the community. It's a trier's, I would imagine, just a little bit of investigation, not much, you would be able to confirm that that actually occurred. But I believe that evidence was presented. And I see my time's up. Should I move to?
Yes.
Okay.
Probably move, unless Justice Jorgensen, Justice Shostak, anything on this issue. All right.
Okay, so let me. All right. One moment, I have to reorient myself here. So Heidi's argument regarding Best Capital Corporation and Art Best Capital Corporation, it relies on form over substance. These entities were mere continuations of the original non-marital partnership, which was Best Investments, despite Heidi's efforts to make them into something more.
Well, do they run, not run, but do they show separately on any of the documents that were presented?
So they do, and they would be required to as a matter of law, because the 1995 tax returns, it would have to show. So Best Capital was formed November 13th, 1995. Therefore, it would have to show the prior entity and the new entity both on the tax returns, because they were both in existence in that year.
Okay,
and
why did they
be a reporting obligation? Now, the fact that there's a new tax ID, I believe that's a fact that really has no importance. If you're changing from the partnership to a corporation, it may have been required. And if it, even if it wasn't required, and that's what he did, it doesn't make it not the same entity. It's formal.
But wasn't that your client's burden of proof to establish all of that and not leave it to the trial court to try to figure it out?
Looking
at two different tax numbers and draw her a reasonable conclusion.
Well, I think the court did draw that conclusion. The court understood that it was all the same entity. And even the change from Best Capital to Art Best Capital Corporation, it was just different iterations of the same non-marital entity, which was formed before the marriage. It was just all that was different, and the court found this to be credible, was just the form and essentially a name change. I mean, it was undisputed that Best Investments was owned with Art and his father years before the party's marriage. Art owned 70%, his father owned 30%. They purchased assets in a building in Glenview, which was discussed, and that was the second outpost of Best Hardware, which was also a non-marital business. Best Hardware paid rent to Best Investments, and Best Investments paid the mortgage. And then in 1995, Art's father transferred his interests in Best Investments to Art. Although Art signed promissory notes, those were ultimately forgiven. And then it was when Art became the sole owner of Best Capital, he decided he wanted to change the name and the structure, and he testified as such. And so in Art's mind, it was the same entity, just continuing. And the court agreed and found it to be credible.
What was the purpose of this particular account? Was it just to hold basically the Best Hardware and maybe some other real estate that they owned?
Yes.
And ultimately sold, or? Okay, yeah. And when did those take place? When did those sales take place?
Well, there was a purchase of this, the Willow Road property that was discussed was one of the properties purchased through Best Capital. So that, the purpose was the non-marital business was to purchase the long-standing location of the original Best Hardware store, which it had been leasing for years. And then Best Hardware, again, was going to pay Best Capital rent, which would then pay off the mortgage, which was the same thing that happened with the Glenview property. Now, the Glenview property was later transferred to purchase one of the party's properties in Florida, right. Casa Bonita. Best Capital was on title. It purchased the Willow Road property for $1,150,000. It had a mortgage from Northview Bank and Trust. The obligee was not ART, it was the corporation. There was evidence, which the court accepted and found to be credible, that a certificate of deposit from Best Hardware and a gift from ART's father paid the majority of the down payment, and that $10,000 came from Best Capital for earnest money. So this,
Well, no, this property that we're talking about basically was for purposes of Best Hardware, or to maybe supplement Best Hardware's income, because there was a point in time when it wasn't doing as well and the one store actually closed. Isn't that correct?
Yes, the Glenview store closed, and that's why that property was sold. But the Northfield location where it had started, that they had been leasing before, the opportunity came to purchase that land, and then they purchased, Best Capital purchased that land. And the credibility of ART about this purchase and the ownership of Best Capital, it is, you know, it's the trial court's province to determine that credibility. Mm-hmm. Nothing has been presented that shows that marital funds were actually used. And if something were contributed, Heidi had the burden to under 503C2A to trace the marriage's contribution, which she never did.
Well, here the trial court does not express any disbelief or concern about Mr. Bess's testimony, correct?
Correct.
It is in the other matters that I'm not even going to mention, because we're not going back there. There was some question about credibility. So there was nothing here that we can point to where she says, nah, that doesn't make any sense.
That's right.
All right. All right. Justice Jorgensen, anything else?
I have nothing else.
And Justice Shostak?
No, thank you.
I guess this is the last time we hear from you, Ms. Keene. So do you have a summary that you'd like to make concerning this case? If a summary is at all possible with all of these pages and exhibits.
I would just say that it is very, the J.P. Morgan stock is able to be traced from the Charter Bank stock all the way through to Raymond James. It all went into the Baird account. Everything that was in the Baird account that affected the J.P. Morgan stock has been accounted for. The UU90 and the 6,600 shares, those can be traced to the original Charter Bank stock, and that's all done through the evidence at trial. The inherited shares, it's plain. They went into the Raymond James account. They remained, a large portion of it remained at the time of judgment. It is wholly unfair for a de minimis contribution of collateral to convert millions of dollars of stock to non-marital stock to marital property. That is not what the statute was intended to do. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Keene. All right, Mr. Page, if you have anything, this is the time.
Okay, Justice, and I'll try to keep it as short and sweet as possible. I'll note, as to this notion of what served as collateral for the margin line, both Mr. Bess and Mr. McGarren, his stockbroker, testified that all of the stock held in the Baird account and later the Raymond James account served as collateral for the margins associated with those accounts. That testimony is, of course, in opposite to the argument that Ms. Keene presented, which is that only some served as collateral.
Yeah, and I'm not sure that the judge specifically said that Mr. McGarren, that she didn't believe Mr. McGarren, but she didn't put a lot of stock in what Mr. McGarren said. Let's put it that way.
Well, Mr. McGarren was the stockbroker. I think it's Mr. Goldsmith that you're thinking of, Justice.
Well, but Mr. McGarren couldn't tell us where the $74,850 came from. Mr. McGarren didn't, and he had been in charge, or not in charge, but these were his accounts from, he was Mr. Bess's father's person too, I believe. I mean, he's been there for a long time, probably longer than I've been here, but he just didn't know some things. So I'm not sure that she was paying much attention to that testimony. She was looking, as you said earlier, at documents.
I believe that's correct. Again, I don't think she necessarily found him not to be credible, but by the same token, he couldn't remember much, and there was no doubt of that. When asked about a lot of these transactions, his testimony was generally, I don't remember where it came from. He did testify pretty clearly on that particular point. Even if that point were true, that the margin line only was secured by some of the shares held in the various accounts. Beginning in May 1998, there's an M next to the Compaq shares that Mr. Bess bought with that $74,000 deposit. So, there was a use of those shares as part of the margin line from the get-go as well. And those Compaq shares served as part of the collateral when Mr. Bess thereafter bought 4,000 shares of Bank One stock and 8,000 shares of First Chicago National Bank stock in August of 1998.
And if I look again at those evidentiary charts, or I don't know what to call them, tracing charts, I guess, I should be able to find the M next to certain pieces within those charts that should explain this to me. Well, it won't.
I'm frankly not looking at them, Justice, and I don't know the answer to that question without looking at them. I don't recall. But I don't remember seeing an M, but again, that's a question for Ms. Keene. As to the rest, in Remarriage of Dan, this court rejected the theory of the burden of the marital estate being a relative consideration for the types of loans that are at issue. There, the husband had posited that he did not burden the marital estate when he used marital property as collateral to purchase what he asserted was non-marital property. And this court rejected that theory. Thereafter, the legislature codified the principle in Dan in Section 503A 6.5. Again, there is no argument to be made that if any marital property is used as collateral, that the resulting property is non-marital. It's in opposite to Section 503A 6.5. To the stock splits, I would point out, this is the NBD bank stock splits that are at issue. The evidence at trial, there was no evidence of stock splits. Mr. Bess, for the first time, either in summation or his motion to reconsider, attached purported printouts of some online newspaper claiming that there had been these stock splits. They were not part of the evidentiary record, and Mr. Bess never asked the trial court to take judicial notice of those purported facts. I would note that it was a private corporation, not a publicly traded corporation, so I certainly don't think that the nature of those stock splits would be beyond dispute.
Was that Northfield Financial?
No, that was the NBD bank that Mr. Bess is now asserting was in part the result of stock splits, the gain in the stock. However, again, Ms. Bess, since it was raised after proofs had closed, never had an opportunity to investigate or look into that issue. And Mr. Bess never made an informative effort to ask the court to take judicial notice of those facts, though we did address it in our response to the motion to reconsider.
This case, just this is a procedural case or question now. From time of filing until time of trial was a little over 2 years. There was this, wasn't it 2018, June of 2018 to October of 2020?
Very good. Yes, that's quite right.
So you've got some, you've got 2 years doing what? Discovery? I mean, I know it's Zoom time and there are other issues going on, but even with the COVID restrictions, you could still do written discovery. You could still do depositions by Zoom or however. So it's, I mean, there was a lot of discovery going on, correct?
There certainly was. We had the trial pushed back a few times, and it's in the record, so it's no secret, because of non-compliance with discovery issues. And Mr. Bess produced a lot of the documents that ultimately went into the evidence at trial shortly before trial began. So yes, though, you know, well, we received a lot of documents shortly before trial. That was not among it, and that was never produced or raised at any point before the trial court until, again, forgiving me, but I, it was either the summation, closing argument, or the motion to reconsider that was raised for the first time. There was no motion to reopen proofs claiming that there had been additional evidence that could have or should have been admitted, or that Mr. Bess had found something that he had missed previously. And with that, Justices, I see my time is up. So if there are no further questions, I will.
Justice Chairman shaking no. Justice Shostak shaking no. And again, I don't have any now, and I'm not going to ask any more later. But if you have some summation, you may make it now.
I'd simply note and tie back to what I began with, which is that this whole appeal, or I should say at least the appeal by Mr. Bess, centers on this notion that he could have received approximately $8 million in assets in exchange for that $200,000 in stock he had before the marriage. There are, to say the least, a lot of holes and leaps and bounds that one has to make to reconcile his argument and his claim with what he had before the marriage. He had the burden at all time to prove that all of these exchanges and all the acquisitions were solely in exchange for non-marital property. And as the trial court found, with the exceptions, of course, which he did find to be non-marital property, he did not do so.
All right. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. I know we've extended time, but a lot of hearings and a lot of pages of exhibits and record, I think, justified that at this time. I would say if anybody's going beyond, which you're, of course, entitled to, when their light goes on, you're done. So hopefully that will be something that you can either pare down or won't be an issue. But we do thank you this morning for your argument and for entertaining our questions. We will make a decision in this matter in due course. And at this point, we will stand adjourned and you are excused. And any persons who were with you are excused from the proceedings. Thank you.
Thank you, Justice.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Justices.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
You too.